Welcome to the Royal College of Psychiatrists podcast. In this bumper episode, our presidential leads for women and mental health, Dr. Philippa Greenfield and Dr. Catherine Durkin, host a conversation to mark International Women's Day with Dr. Amrit Sarkar, joint presidential lead for equity and equality, and Louise Howard, emeritus professor of women's mental health at King's College London. The conversation looks over the specific determinants and risk factors that impact disproportionately on women's mental health and much more. So without further ado, let us begin.
I am Philippa Greenfield. I'm Joint Presidential Lead for Women and Mental Health at the Royal College of Psychiatrists. I'm a general adult psychiatrist, and my interest has really been around how we consider the impact of trauma and inequality on those accessing mental health services and how we can improve responses in healthcare.
Hi, I'm Kath Durkin. I'm a consultant forensic psychiatrist, and I'm the clinical lead for women in prison in CNWL. So clinically, I very much work on the ground in the women's prisons surrounding London and the southeast of the UK.
Hi, I'm Amrit Sarkar. I'm a liaison psychiatry consultant working in West London, working in A&E and on the wards with long-term conditions, but also with emergencies. And I am the joint presidential lead for equity and equality.
Hi, I'm Louise Howard. I'm Professor Emerita in Women's Mental Health at King's College London. And I have spent the last 30 years working on gender determinants of mental health and also how to improve the response for women in particular.
Thank you so much, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Amrit. Thank you, Louise. Philippa and I think, thinking about what we wanted to have a conversation about for International Women's Day, which we're celebrating this week, is really reflecting on our work in the college as presidential leads for women's mental health. And actually, how do we get the message across to everybody in the public, at the college, psychiatrists, about what we see are the specific determinants and risk factors that impact disproportionately on women? And Louise, I might come to you first, because I often feel like I'm here in this role because I'm really passionate about working with women, and I've done it for 6 years in the women's prisons. And I think there's something about that particular lens that I've been exposed to for the last few years that's made me think we really get this wrong, actually. And I hear the same narrative over and over again amongst the women that I work with. And I can kind of shout it from the rooftops. And I think I do that a lot, trying to tell the stories of women. And where I think, interestingly, in this role, what's helpful is often to triangulate. I see one particular kind of narrative through my own lens in a particular part of the system. And what I was hoping today is we all come together, because we all work in different parts of the system and have different resources at our disposal to tell that same story. And I think it's a story, interestingly, that some people, well, a lot of the system doesn't want to hear. For a myriad of different reasons. And so today, I might come to you first, Louise, because of all that experience, and say, actually, if I was to signpost someone who's not familiar with this field and say, what are the key pieces of research or data that really underpin the story that we're trying to tell, where would I send someone to go to first?
Okay, well, thanks for that. I'm thrilled to be here on International Women's Day. It's an interesting one, because actually, if you start off with the basics, the epidemiology, the differences between women and men, everybody agrees on that. What people maybe are not so interested in always is trying to understand why things are different and what implications that has for people getting into care, and also what that care should look like. And actually, it may not need to look like exactly the same for everybody. Person. Indeed, it probably shouldn't look exactly the same. So I think starting at the basics and saying, you know, why is it that women are more likely to experience depressive episodes than men? What do people think about that? And we know, of course, a lot of the evidence, but it might get people thinking a little bit more. And then coming to services, which is what the college is about, I think, more than anything, and trying to improve services, is Well, what do services look like and are they set up right for women and men? And it is at that point women themselves are so able to tell us, well, actually, this isn't working for us. I mean, I actually originally thought I was going to be spending my career on perinatal mental health. But when I started to ask women about what their needs were and what should services be doing, what they were telling me about was, well, we're asked about childhood abuse. We are never asked about the abuse in our current relationships. And I just feel too embarrassed to talk about them. But that is a huge problem for me. So it's about asking the women what they want addressed. And of course, there's many other examples that I could give. But I think knowing what the differences are and then trying to establish, well, why? And what can we do about that? And how should treatments be modified? And the implications are huge because it means that we need to rethink how we do research, to my mind.
And it's really interesting. It's really interesting just hearing that, because one of the things I've shared with Kath when we've spoken before is exactly that. I actually, my interest has always been working with people who have developed psychosis. And I was involved working with an early intervention service in 2014 now, at the time where we were thinking about extending age range in early intervention services. And I was asked to do some data looking at actually if we extended the age range of early intervention services past the age of 35, what did we need to focus on? What did that group look like? And what were the needs of that group? And this really opened my mind. And as I said, working probably with men before that, largely thinking about psychosis in men, what I saw from that data and research is as soon as you start to open the service to those over 35, surprise, surprise, I suppose, with what we know about that already, of where we see peaks in psychosis presentations in women, but we started to see women in higher numbers accessing the services. And when you looked at the needs around women accessing those services, the needs were different. They were around experiences of domestic and sexual violence. They were around traumatic loss. So thinking about child loss, thinking about traumatic bereavement. So the needs look really different. And actually, it was my first point of saying, well, actually, then we haven't, this wouldn't be, the current model wouldn't be the service that we would need for women. If we were setting up a psychosis service for women, the focus, the needs, the skill mix that we need in our service needs to look very different. And so it's interesting just hearing your story, thinking you're going to work in perinatal psychiatry, me similarly thinking, imagining who I might be working with and actually how that's really shaped my interest. And actually this idea that we're not really providing the right, perhaps the narrative for what brings women to services and how we are equipped in our services to manage that. And therefore, does that surprise us that perhaps, you know, that we're not improving outcomes for women if we're in services that are not understanding their needs? And again, yeah.
Well, and I think that's so interesting. And I think, Louise, you've made a really interesting point, is that actually your research was about asking women, what do they need and what's important for them? And I think often what we've done is we've started perhaps with saying, well, what are the end result? What are the symptom clusters that we know and we're comfortable with from a very sort of, you know, medical model of psychosis or of depression or of anxiety? And then we've sort of calculated and said, well, that must be the service that women need, rather than listening to women's experiences and saying, actually, the majority of this is going to be underpinned by your experiences of adversity, of deprivation, and of interpersonal violence across your life course. And actually, if we can start with that when we're thinking about what women need, and we can ask that question, because often I think the system, I think as individuals, we're not able to ask that question because it's too difficult sometimes for us to hear the answer, either because we feel ill-equipped perhaps to be able to do something to improve that, or it's just too traumatising and it's too difficult. So we've sort of shied away from it and gone, well, let's think about this in a very kind of medicalised way, because I think that's easier and that's where our comfort zone is. But actually, I feel that we need to move away from that, because working in a prison, I can't think of a patient that I've spoken to in the last 6 years who hasn't had a cumulative experience of trauma throughout their lives, but who's also perhaps been diagnostically underplayed and told that they have an emotionally unstable personality disorder because they've had an absolutely horrific experience throughout their lives. And we haven't been able to meet their needs. We've kind of othered and sort of dismissed and denigrated those women and done them out of the service. Amrit, I know that's something you were thinking about, actually, particularly when we think about the kind of diagnostic framework that we use. We often end up using it in a very gendered way for women.
Yeah, I'm really interested in the concept of diagnostic overshadowing. So one, Kath, as you said, overdiagnosis of EUPD just simply based on the trauma experiences, and then using that diagnosis to not really think about what's going on for that person. It's a shorthand to perhaps write them off, or worse still, a shorthand for a kind of implicit reason to exclude them from services. We see it a lot. This person's got EUPD, this woman's got EUPD, therefore an inpatient admission isn't warranted, it won't help. There's lots of exclusion that goes on. So it's the stigma, the stigmatising is actually really risky. The other thing I wanted to pick up on was just thinking about the avalanche of people who are currently walking into emergency departments up and down the country because the system really is falling over, not just the health system, but the social system and wider issues in society. And the things that we call social determinants of health are often the reasons that people are presenting to me in acute crisis. And I'm just really struck by the untenable position that my teams are put in when there's so much to do in A&E and somebody presents with a problem that ostensibly looks like a housing crisis, but they're suicidal because of it. And just how much within our health services we are so able to silo those two things off, that because it's just a housing crisis, it's not a health issue, and therefore the suicidality is downgraded somehow, just as a way for our teams to manage the mismatch between demand and capacity. And then I think going on from that, just the cognitive dissonance that comes into our brains when we're trying to manage that mismatch, and how actually we end up, unfortunately, somehow medically gaslighting our patients and blaming them for not fitting into our services. So it's the opposite of patient-centred care, it's kind of service-centred care. And that's not to blame anyone, but just kind of making explicit the challenges that people are facing on a day-to-day basis.
But it raises this issue, doesn't it, about what is women's mental health? Because, as you said, it's just a housing problem. It's just the fact that you've experienced this horrendous trauma. It's just this and that being othered. Whereas actually the question is this women's mental health, or is this mental health, actually? Mm. And actually the fact that we don't see these issues as health issues becomes, with us, especially the data that we're gathering, becomes more and more problematic, because absolutely we are understanding this is mental health, and particularly with what we're talking about today, this is women's mental health. And I'm really interested in that. And I suppose more than that as well, you know, we've touched a little bit on diagnosis. One of the things that's really interests me around, for example, you know, we use the example of an emotionally unstable personality disorder. It's really interesting, isn't it? Because I work a lot around trauma-informed approaches. And really the ethos of that is what has happened to you, not what is wrong with you. And automatically that is, that is automatically saying there is something fundamentally wrong with you, rather than saying, we understand the trauma and adversity that is usually associated with attracting that diagnosis. But we're saying there's something wrong with you, rather than saying, this is, you know, giving somebody, I suppose, you know, we have trauma services for men, we have veterans services, for example. So rather than, you know, why are we not naming, I suppose, arguably some of our services, domestic abuse services for women? We're fundamentally in that language, we're saying there's something wrong with you, rather than acknowledging that something has happened to you. And I suppose it does get us thinking about, actually, when we're thinking about research then, when we're thinking about data in this area, how do we start to, I don't know, is that narrative shifting through the data that we're collecting? Are we able to show that? I don't know what you think, Louise.
You raised so many interesting things there. I was thinking before we got onto data, but just coming back to the basics of clinical practice, is that I have felt that the concept of a diagnostic formulation, with more about the formulation bit rather than the diagnostic bit, has been a bit lost. Yeah. I was quite impressed when I was working with a whole range of colleagues on depression, many of whom had focused their lives on biological research. But what we were all absolutely agreed on for the Lancet Depression Commission was, we've got to get back to diagnostic formulation across the world for psychiatry. This is so important because patients are alienated by, you know, it just being about diagnosis. It's not helpful for services. It's not helpful for understanding. And I completely sympathise with juniors in casualty having, you know, four more to see. They know there's the time pressure on them, as well as just even if it's just about going back the next day to have a think about what was the diagnostic formulation, it would just be more interesting, wouldn't it, for them as well. And then when it comes to data, well, actually, you'd be amazed how little diagnosis data makes it into data sets. So, you know, we're all told we have to do it, but actually, it's extraordinary how many people across the country are not doing it. We've just published a few papers using national data sets, and diagnosis was really only being completed in 80% of cases by inpatient services. It just wasn't there. Now, this is a few years ago, but it was mandated then as well. And so I was kind of surprised by the fact that diagnosis isn't getting there. The problem with other types of data, like, you know, different determinants, social determinants for men and women, a lot of that data is not part of the mandatory mental health minimum data sets either. And so there, we do need to think about, what are we asking the trusts to return? And this is fantastic data. I mean, you know, we've looked at really interesting things. We've been able to look at the adverse obstetric outcomes of women in contact with mental health services. So it's not useless data as it is, but it could be so much more if we were able to collect just a few more variables of really important gendered and other social determinants, I think.
I think that is so interesting, and I know it's a podcast, so people can't see that I was sort of clapping as well as I was so excited listening to what you say, because I think this is absolutely the crux of it. And I don't know, again, with our struggles with trying to pigeonhole people into particular diagnostic labels, if that, again, if there's a sort of sex disaggregation to that, if we're better or worse with women and men, because, and I also wonder if it's sort of reassuring or not to hear that actually across the country people are struggling with the same thing, which is, how do you compress this myriad of experiences that people have had across the life course into one or two diagnoses? Or you end up with someone who's got 17 diagnoses of, you know, ADHD, CPTSD, EPD, and then everyone goes, oh, well, none of these can be right, because somehow that really undermines what's going on. And I'm an absolute advocate of, when I sit in clinic, and it's the same with the MDT, we will have a conversation about someone that we've seen, and we will all go, look, I just don't know what's going on, because I need time. And actually, the way that someone will present, as Amrit said, there's a sort of primacy in terms of, there's a lot going on, but today it might be that I haven't got access to my children, and it was my daughter's birthday, and I'm in prison, and I'm devastated because I can't ring her. Or it might be that they see Amrit in A&E and say, actually, I'm about to lose my housing, which is hugely important. Or it might be that on that particular day, everything was too much and they needed to use substances to be able to kind of mitigate that overwhelm that they're experiencing. And I really feel this, unless you can see someone on a kind of continuum, it is very, very difficult to diagnostically go in after one assessment with the best will in the world and go, I absolutely know what's happening. Because there are layers and layers, also thinking about physical health and sort of psychotropic medication and kind of pain relief medication, as well as, you know, brain injury, neurodiversity. There is so much in there that somehow diagnoses kind of precludes us from understanding. And I find it very, very frustrating to say, I'm going to tick one box on your read code, and that's how you're going to then be able to navigate your way through a pathway. because it will or won't open doors to you. And I feel very passionately what we need is time and the opportunity to see people. And again, you know, in an overworked A&E or in a triage in a prison or in a kind of, you know, referrals to a psychosis service, we don't have that. And that's a real problem for me, because then we can't understand women in a kind of holistic way, and we end up becoming really split. So we're really split as a system, and we really split the individual, going, well, actually, we're just going to focus on the fact that we think maybe you're depressed. But that sort of misses all of the other stuff that's going on. How we resolve that, I don't know, because I know that plays to a real resource issue. But it's interesting, Louise, that you've raised that, and actually the research has evidenced that diagnostically, we really struggle to kind of put people into those particular boxes.
I think, Amrit, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I'm nervous about moving the conversation on, but it's not really, it's, I'm just also thinking about some of the ways that we think about barriers to access services are very, we don't think about the woman and everything that a woman's life includes. And I've been really struck in my diabetes work where, you know, most people who are struggling to keep their BMs at the number that they should know all the facts. We just keep re-educating them. So what is it then that is stopping this person from being able to engage in the treatment plan that they should be going under? And I've had a huge cohort of women with type 2 diabetes who had multiple other long-term conditions, but they had multiple care burdens. And what we know is that women prioritise everybody else's care and nurturing before they prioritise their own health. And I was really struck by a certain cohort of middle-aged women who were just struggling to find the time to even think about that. And they would directly challenge you to say, I don't. And I don't think we think about that. When we think about the social determinants, they're all quite kind of solid things. And we don't really think about what it takes for a woman to be able to put herself first.
But I think you're quite right. And this comes to, but it comes to this question, I suppose, is how we don't, how we don't understand the intersecting factors that affect women's lives. And I mean, even, you know, I think as we would all agree, it's not as simple as saying somebody comes with one issue or one problem. And as you said, and also, you know, whether you think about that when we're thinking why somebody is accessing a service or attempting to access a service, why there are barriers for that person accessing a service, and why there are challenges to maybe think, you know, around thinking about help, recovery, all of these sorts of things. And I think at every step, we need to be thinking about those intersecting factors, don't we? And I think that you really illustrate that well when we're thinking about barriers. But I really think that we still don't do that. We talk about, as you said, if we term it social determinants, for example, we're still used to thinking about one. We're not used to thinking about multiple of those and how they interplay and how they amplify risk. And one of the things that's been really interesting to me, and Kath actually, in a lot of the work that we've been doing, we've been talking about this, when we're thinking about the wider women's health strategy, for example, and how we can influence that at the moment, so often, I suppose, the focus is birth trauma, the focus is pelvic pain. So all these really important issues for women. But we're not all impacted equally by these issues as well. And also, you know, to think when we're sort of thinking, well, what voice as psychiatrists should we be bringing to this, to the discussion about these things? One of the real challenges is thinking, actually, the women that we tend to see in our services or the women that seem to have the most complex needs in our services don't come with just, and as I say, I don't minimise this in any way, but they don't just come with but a birth trauma. A traumatic birth, which many of us will face, but they come with all the challenges that we know actually are going to lead to them having a birth trauma in the first place. And all of the problems that you've spoken about, Amrit, about actually accessing care and accessing the right support for that timely before, you know, before the mental health problem. So all of these problems that are happening actually that we know about before somebody then is going to have this that we're not doing anything about, and understanding all of the factors that would then increase their outcomes. And that's not just one, you know, just as I say, if you think about the fact of having a mental illness for the, you know, in terms of a barrier in itself for so many of these things, let alone thinking about poverty, thinking about all of these other factors. And I'm really interested, and again, partly why we put this group, you know, invited yourself, Amrit and Louise, to speak to this. It's, we've got to move forward in this way, haven't we? We can't just be thinking about a single issue or a single problem for, you know, a single issue, but actually how we account for somebody coming with all of these challenges and barriers, or all of this sort of loading for poor outcomes, I suppose. And I wonder if either of you want to say anything about that, or your thoughts on how we might do better there, or start to do better.
Amrit, do you want to go first?
Yeah. So I think that it's absolutely vital. So we're talking about the concept of intersectionality. So the idea that one protected characteristic or disadvantage added to another have a synergistic effect, more than either of those would have, more than the sum of the two parts. And sometimes we're talking about very many intersectional factors. And it's interesting, so the college has a QI program called Advancing Mental Health Equality that I've been a part of recently, and just trying to talk about intersectionality and the concept of equity, which listeners will know equity is different from equality, where equality is giving the same resource to everybody regardless of need, and equity is honing the resource according to the need, so that everybody has the same opportunity for outcomes. It's really interesting talking to teams, and they're overwhelmed by the number of different things that they have to think about. So, for example, we know that Black women have the worst outcomes in maternity care, etc. And for me, the easiest way is not to go, right, I'm going to have some sort of matrix that ticks off all of these things. I just think the simplest thing is to have one of your most complex patients in mind when you're designing your service, a person who you can name and visualize and remember, and say, right, if I design this service around this person, I call mine Grace. If I design my service around Grace, what does she need? What will be the access issues? What will be the outcome issues and the experience issues for her? So if I design around the most marginalized, then actually we know from various studies, like the various experiences, that if you design around the most marginalized, you improve things for everybody, often referred to as the dropped curb effect. So when the curb was dropped for people with wheelchairs, actually lots of people benefited around the town planning. So that for me is kind of a simple way of not letting teams on the front line not feel overwhelmed. I was thinking about something else, but I've forgotten what it is. So over to you, Louise.
Okay, well, I guess the other thing I was thinking about from a very quantitative perspective, and I really like Grace. I think Grace sounds really important. But I also think that planners also need, or often want, very quantitative data. And the challenge with giving quantitative data and thinking about intersectionality is that sometimes the intersectional groups become quite small, and people say, oh, you can't say much about that then, because you haven't got the statistical power. And the answer, of course, is to design the study differently, right? So if you're thinking about particular marginalized groups, you need to have specific recruitment strategies so that you do oversample, so that you can find out what is going on here. But of course, even before that, you need to have the right research question. you know, I mean, are you actually going to be just looking at women and men, or are you also going to be thinking about many other intersecting factors? And the example that I just love from one of my best ever PhD students, because PhD students teach you so much, she wanted to look at the experience of migrant women. And in Southeast London, we have a lot of very traumatised migrant women. And what she wanted to look at was their mental health different? And, you know, that you'd expect it to be different for some migrant groups, not for others, not for, you know, the people that are coming over for a better job. Clearly, they're not the same. And of course, ethnicity is going to play a role. But what was really interesting is that the actual groups showed us so much. So not only, for example, did we find that women from a variety of ethnic backgrounds who were migrants actually didn't have more common mental disorders in terms of depression and anxiety. They were a really resilient bunch. You've got to be pretty resilient to come over from a war-torn country, you know, and they were actually doing really well. So who was it out of those migrant women who'd had a lot of adversity who did not so well? Well, she then again, you know, got smaller groups, but because she'd pre-planned this analysis, she had fairly decent sized groups for her study. And she found that it was women with insecure immigration status that did really badly, because, you know, having a baby when you don't know what on earth is going to happen to you, and at 38 weeks, you might suddenly be told you've got to go and live in Scotland with no support. Those are the women who had PTSD. Their PTSD symptoms were from the various experiences they'd had, but other women had had similar experiences. But if they had now had secure housing, they had secure immigration status, they were no longer no recourse to public funds, the whole experience was so different for them. And then actually they can contribute a lot to this country as they want to, you know, and it's just so frustrating to see people just left in limbo for so long. So if you ask the right questions and look at the right data set, sometimes, although the categories might be small, you can manage to show planners what's important.
That's so interesting, Louise. And I was thinking, you were saying that it was one of your PhD students, and maybe I was wondering sort of, that PhD study sounds so, so useful, so interesting. How do you think there is a barrier kind of higher up the academic chain when we're looking at funding of much bigger studies, sort of more with more national power, that means that actually a lot of these ideas and really important studies that's being done, able to be done at a PhD level, isn't able to be translated up into bigger studies where we can sort of showcase that information more widely? I don't know, is that the case?
Well, there's a lot of competition for research funding. Yeah. That's certainly the case. And funding bodies often look very differently. When I had actually managed to get as far as a stage two application on a domestic violence research programme set in, you know, frontline services, and we're developing an intervention, et cetera, had great reviews. And the panel said they didn't see it as a priority, as a priority issue, and it didn't score as highly. That things are changing, though, because actually NIHR did put intimate partner violence as one of their prevention priorities. It's just that things take so long to change. But, you know, you've just got to be there for the long haul, really. If it doesn't happen the first time, and you know, in order to be an academic, you have to be extremely bloody minded and persistent. And I'm still, you know, I'm still trying to create some change. It goes as far as, you know, who's on the board of the different journals. And I know the British Journal of Psychiatry has been trying really hard to have more diversity on their editorial board. But, you know, it's so many different levels. And of course, your institution is terribly important as well, in terms of fostering that type of research. And then there's the dissemination, who wants to listen. So, you know, it is a struggle to get it heard, because there are lots of really other important issues at the moment. There's just so much, isn't there, in the news. But I think that there has been some improvement. I think there is change. It just takes quite a while, unfortunately.
Actually, just to kind of follow up with one point from that, Louise, is just even thinking about the concept of SMI. And it's something that Philip and I have had many conversations about in terms of what is a severe and enduring mental illness? Because lots of the women that I historically have seen wouldn't necessarily have sort of reached a definition, I guess, classically of a severe and enduring mental illness, but absolutely for sure have really significant enduring mental health difficulties and impairment associated with that. And I think it's interesting that even as a profession, we've tended to sort of, again, discriminate against women diagnostically in terms of understanding their need and their experience, because we haven't quantified it in quite the same way. Or it looks slightly different. So there's absolutely the experience of psychosis, but that psychosis might be much more kind of relapsing and remitting on a much, you know, not necessarily captured in the same way. So I think progress has been made in the sense that complex PTSD is being increasingly recognised as an SMI. I'm doing my kind of finger sort of, you know, abbreviation to sort of highlight that. But I think that really neglects a lot of what we see. And again, where the threshold is for mental health, and of course, it's a resource issue about how, you know, we are spread exceptionally thinly, but we know that there's kind of an epidemic of people experiencing difficulties with their mental health. And actually, where do we set the bar to kind of do as much as we can to support the population? Because we know that actually the majority of women will access primary care, you know, for their kind of mental health problems will be conceived in a primary care way rather than necessarily ending up in secondary mental health services. And I think there's a kind of deficit at all levels of the system in terms of how we respond to women's mental health from an inpatient point of view, but also if we think about secondary care and where the services are and who's able to fit into that. Again, we're thinking very much about intersectionality. Who do we sort of discriminate against to never get really into the system? And who will rely actually much more on kind of family and friends for support, where we haven't been able to kind of offer a service and recognise the need that a lot of the women have.
If one goes even further out, I think that focusing on what can we do to address these social determinants, though, then it's less of our problem. I mean, it's still a problem. Who do we have the capacity to see and who do we not have the capacity to see? Definitely. But at the same time, if public health interventions could really address some of these determinants, and of course, it's a really hard time for public health. They're being, you know, it's not a priority, I don't think, for this government at the moment. But the college is actually doing some really interesting things around public health. And I think psychiatrists could be more advocates around those sort of public mental health interventions, as well as thinking about what we do at an individual level. It's like when you're a medical student, you're thinking, well, do I want to be a psychiatrist? Because I can see that these people that are being seen actually reflect the terrible things that have gone on in their lives, and is it what I should be doing, you know, going off into a specialty where I'm not going to be able to do anything about those terrible things? Well, maybe we actually can do some things, you know, maybe we can actually do something about those things. We can be advocates, we can know more about where to influence the public health system, and I think what the college is doing around that is really interesting, and I'm very pleased to see that.
And maybe for people who are listening to this, I mean, it's both thinking about what they are or what the things we could be influencing from a public health point of view, because we've talked about quite a lot of these sorts of things. But something you and I, Louise, have been very much involved with some of the public health work has been around how we think about domestic abuse, for example, and what we can be doing at all levels. So cross-sector in health, but across other sectors, but also whatever your role, not just psychiatrists, to really address this issue. But what are the other sorts? So just to reflect a bit, and Amrit, you might have some thoughts as well. What are the things are we aware of that we really think we should be prioritising around public mental health as psychiatrists and promoting, and anything that we are doing about those, perhaps in the college, thinking people might be, you know, that we can be really spreading that message that these are things we feel we should be investing in, particularly if we want to improve outcomes for women. And that's to anybody here. So what would be the other sort of key things for those who are that we really think we should be focusing on for women?
I think things like minimum alcohol pricing are very interesting, and seeing what difference that makes. I know, you know, Scotland's ahead of us in this respect, and they're actually, I think, increasing again the minimum price. And what that does in terms of spikes of violence, not just domestic violence, but also spikes of other, you know, other types of violence, One can think one thing think about other types of determinants of violence. There's a really interesting paper that I came across this week on the impact of the hostile environment on the mental health of marginalised groups. Really lovely, lovely study. I can't remember who it's by, but it's in the Lancet Psychiatry, showing an impact of the hostile environment that was introduced in 2016 by Theresa May. So, you know, I think studies can bring something to the conversation. So lots of people might be not feeling comfortable about that hostile environment, but not know what they can say from a psychiatric perspective. Well, there's a study now that actually can show how unhelpful it can be to mental health of people who, you know, usually actually do have the right to stay once their asylum case has been fully heard, but it's taking so long. So, yeah, those sort of things I think are really interesting research-wise and, you know, really need to be brought into the conversation in the public arena.
I think what that highlights for me is having a real conversation about the mismatch between what we know will help, like minimum pricing for alcohol, but the fact that we're not the only ones lobbying government, that corporate interests are pulling against that all the time. And so how do we, I don't know, how do we have an impact there when actually the Treasury purse is affected by something that has a positive impact on public health? And that's the real tension. But I think that the college has a really powerful lobbying voice. I think there's something about joining forces with other organisations, specifically patient organisations and you know, third sector and other colleges. And so I think there's something about coming the partnerships here to have a powerful lobby voice.
I think you're so right there, Amrit. And I think that goes across the piece, actually, when it comes to research as well, that looking for evidence from those other sectors that also have their own very helpful perspective, which will be very different to psychiatry, will be really helpful. So if you're thinking about your research design, you know, you first of all want what's the research question of importance to those communities that you're talking about researching? And then if you're thinking about the treatments that psychiatrists might be offering, well, have we looked at things that might influence response to treatment? Does gender make a difference? That often has just not been looked at. So this is coming back to psychiatrists' individual role with their patients. But it does mean that at the broader level, funders, policymakers understand that data needs to be disaggregated and that actually that goes right across the piece from epidemiology to intervention studies to public health interventions.
I think it's so important, Louise, the point about disaggregated data, whether it's disaggregated by sex or any of the other protected characteristics. And we definitely know that the umbrella term BAME for non-white populations really hides and dilutes a lot of the worst outcomes, because we know that Black women and Bangladeshi women and Gypsy Roma traveller women do much worse in health outcomes, whether it's maternity or their own health. And yet, if you cluster all of those women's data together, you don't see the worse outcomes for the subcategories. So the need to disaggregate this data is absolutely vital, so that we can figure out whether we're making a difference when we target those populations, and to figure out, you know, which populations to target. And I guess coming on from that is the well-recognised fact that
our ethnicity data for sure, but also some of our other protected characteristic data, is really poorly recorded. We have poor completion rates and we have really poor accuracy dates data. And it's so interesting when you try and address those gaps or errors in the data. There seems to be a bit of a squeamishness amongst healthcare staff to ask patients these bits of information about themselves. And it makes me wonder if actually one of the things we need to be doing nationally is having a campaign to communicate and engage in a conversation with the public about why we need to collect this data so that people aren't paranoid or worried about what's going to happen with the data, but understand that it's to target populations who are not getting the best care at the moment to improve their outcomes.
I think that's a really interesting point, Amrit. And as you said, it's thinking about, as you said, how we disaggregate or how we really look, you know, what is data really telling us and how are we really breaking that down? As I say, for when we're thinking about sex disaggregation, but also particularly just when we think about other protected characteristics and ethnicity. I was having a very interesting conversation with an academic recently who's very interested when we think about the group of white other, when we're thinking about ethnicity and actually really what that means, and then thinking about health outcomes for people who are in this white other category. And it makes me think a little bit about what you were saying earlier, Louise, about the research from your PhD student for exactly that. It really doesn't, you know, I suppose without that understanding, we're really not, you know, we're not understanding the challenges and the strengths as well, you know, all of these sorts of things, you know, and as I say, it's really unhelpful. And I think we do need to move to a place that we're really wanting to be interested in that, rather than just continue something that's very binary and grouping of, you know, as I say, whether that's diagnostically, whether that, as I said, is these very broad categories, but we really need to be doing better with that. How do we move forward with it? I mean, you've talked to some of the challenges, Louise. I say challenges, but also some of the ways that we can, you know, you were saying about it, there's so many systems involved. We're thinking about research, and we're thinking about, you know, from a data perspective, but also talking about some very positive things that are going on or that we can be doing. What do we see as next steps? And I'd be interested in what everybody thinks to that.
I guess... I think that we need to, when it comes to research, and I should have mentioned that my fantastic PhD student's called Fraser Anderson, and she's a clinical psychologist now, and doing great work. So, yeah, I mean, I think from the beginning, we need to be aware of what it is, the complexity of the research question. But of course, you have to make it a testable research question by, you know, co-researching with people with lived experience, really important what is actually important to them. And that goes from not just designing the research question, but it's about, you know, thinking about recruitment. How do we overcome barriers to recruitment in the same way as barriers to engaging with services? Right down to, you know, what is it important that we want to do in the analysis and interpretation and dissemination? And of course, you need financial support if you're going to do real co-produced research. So that needs to be put into your grants, making sure your funder understands the importance of that. And then looking at, I think, you know, my focus has been gendered specific moderators, but of course there are many other moderators of response to treatment. And I think that if we can get real diversity on the boards of funding panels, and I think there is a real understanding that that's needed, on editorial boards of journals, of NICE, which I think also does try hard and is a really interesting organisation as well. And also making sure that the new early career researchers understand the importance of all of this. And so when they're having their research teaching, that's integrated into the teaching as well. I think this is a really exciting time, though, because I think this is a time of real change. People are doing things differently. And hopefully in 10 years' time, maybe this webinar wouldn't even be needed. You never know.
So Louise rightly mentioned the importance of co-production in research studies, and I think we also need to talk about how important it is to do real co-production in service design and ongoing evaluation. I'm struck by how people still feel that they don't have time to do co-production because it will somehow slow things down, and actually it feels like it's a stitch in time sort of analogy. I think that if you don't do co-production and get women's voices right at the beginning, then you're going to end up reworking things and not getting the right outcomes. And I just wonder what people's experiences of trying to get this done in their national or local work has been.
I suppose I'd just start by echoing that. I think about the women who I work with. And again, I know that Cass, you've spoken similarly about women in prison. And again, I think it is, there are lots of barriers to accessing, you know, there are lots of barriers actually what you feel for what the women may be putting themselves forward with certain, mm-hmm. Well, I suppose when we're thinking about more with complex needs, you know, complex mental health needs, but it's more than that. All the structural barriers that may have supported them being able to, you know, access care in the first place, to maybe actively putting themselves, you know, it's putting themselves in a position to say be, you know, experts by experience or providing their voice. But we need to be doing more. We can't say, you know, we still need to be getting those voices. We still need to be hearing from women across the spectrum about, you know, of you know, people who access our services. And I certainly still don't think we do that. I certainly don't see that represented when I'm reading research or certainly thinking about when things are planned. I don't see the voice of some of the women I work with represented in lots of, you know, document strategy, spoken about, but not seeing their voices. And as I said, I don't know, Louise, Kath, any thoughts about that? But I just think that there is a real gap in how we're doing that at the moment. We must do better.
Do you want to go first, Louise, or shall I?
You go.
I mean, again, I completely echo it. And I think it plays into this really interesting power dynamic that goes on of who is visible and whose voice do we as a system want to hear from, and where are the particular gaps? Again, if we think about sort of intersectionality and who do we as a system continue to reinforce not hearing from? And also, again, particularly thinking about the life course, and we've been doing some work focused on the menopause and the perimenopausal period, but actually I think if you spoke to lots of women in the midlife, again, where's the research about experience from a mental health point of view kind of intersecting with sort of hormonal underpinnings? Who do we consider sort of worthy of in society of actually hearing their voice, and who is able, has the mechanisms to have their voices heard? But I agree with you, Philippa. I think there's something as well when I think about a really complex traumatized population where there's a reticence to say, actually, why am I going to re-communicate information that I have communicated before to, in theory, trusted professionals, and nothing's been done with that? Mm-hmm. I haven't been validated, and actually I've been traumatized by trying to do that and convey that message, because we haven't been able to hear that message adequately, and we haven't been able to kind of meet the needs of society. But just to reflect on one bit, because I think working with women in prison is a really interesting space in terms of access, and we do everything that we can, again, sort of geographically from a risk point of view, to make it very difficult and complicated to have the experience of women in prison's voices heard. And again, if we look at it kind of nationally, there's only up to 4,000 women in prison at a time. So we are a very kind of niche in theory area, but we're not, because I think women really in prison represent a kind of, again, this interplay of lots of different social disadvantage. But there was a piece of work that was done, actually it was by NHS England and HMPPS, which was the Women's Health and Social Care Review that was released at the end of last year, that was fantastic. And the reason it was so fantastic is because it had so much evidence from the women in prison themselves. And that for me is what made that piece of work incredibly powerful. And actually that, I suppose that brings us back to kind of where we started a little bit with the conversation, having the data from a quantitative point of view, but sort of having that richness of context from a qualitative perspective and saying, look, tell us your experiences. when you're reading that, I think particularly as a non-academic, that's what really lands and resonates with me. So being able to have and capture women's voices in the work that we do, how we design services is imperative, but I still think we're not good at it for so many different reasons.
I think the only thing I would add is the need for support for the people that are being asked and agree to do this work, because as you say, they've put themselves forward or been persuaded to be part of the process, but actually it might be quite difficult for them. And so to actually make sure that there is enough support for them is important, and maybe sometimes not always thought about by other planners of services.
And I think the thing I would add to all the great points you guys have already made is going back to that idea of asset focused or asset based rather than deficit based. So rather than poor you, this is a thing we're doing to you, it's saying you've got an amazing perspective and you've clearly got loads of resilience, and we need to be learning from you as a true expert. And for that, we do need to make sure that we're not just having one token person in a meeting full of CEOs and board members in suits. So there needs to be a critical mass of voices in a forum, and we need to treat them as experts in the same way as we're experts, so they need to be paid. So those are some of the things that the college is doing, and the college has written a document for co-production called Working Together, I believe, which kind of breaks things down in quite a simple way. But I think my call to action would be really challenging to people out there, really challenging the idea that you don't have time to do co-production. I would say you don't have time not to do co-production, actually.
And I suppose in terms of the call for action, the only thing I was interested is Kath's been, you know, with Amrit saying about the COP 20 plus 5 and actually how should we develop that? One of Kath's very much thinking is, do we need something like that that makes us, you know, for particularly for women? I don't know if you want to say something about that, Kath, but again, would that help with some of these things that Louise is, you know, I suppose with some of the things that have all been discussed?
Yes, it was one of our, Philippa and mine's many brainstorming is actually, could we reduce this down to kind of a core 20 plus 5 idea of actually, here's the woman and here are all the variables that we have very strong evidence for, as well as clinically to say, look, this is the cohort that's at risk. And I think it's something that if I ever got technically skilled enough to put a really good slide together, that's the work in progress for me, we'd like to use as a really clear visual representation. Because I think, you know, Philippa, I'm struck by the role of the presidential lead for women and mental health is to say, because I think it's still not well understood in terms of a call for action, actually women are not a fringe group. We're 51% of the population. Women's health is not niche. And actually we need to get everybody to understand that message, to be able to say, can we stop feeling, you know, can we stop marginalizing women? Can we stop marginalizing our experiences and bring that into the mainstream nationally, cross-sector? That, for me, is a lot of the work that we're going to be trying to do with our Make Women's Mental Health Matter strategy, and collating all of that evidence from lived experience, from data, from anecdotals, from all of the people that we've been having such interesting conversations with, so that hopefully we can have a really clear message that this is everybody's business, because actually we need to improve this for everybody if we're going to improve mental health outcomes. So that would be my call to action, as well as to go and learn how to use a kind of fancy web Excel, whatever spreadsheet, to make a really nice infographic for that as well.
But I think the really positive thing about our conversation today, because I think that's a fantastic way to end, Kath, I think the really fantastic thing to say is, you know, with everybody here and with the expertise of everybody contributing today, is actually it's possible. It's very possible. We do have the foundations in place to start to do this. But as you said, it's the issue, Kath, of actually how we start to really talk to this and talk to this in a way that it's everybody's business. But I think we should finish there for today. And thank you so much for the conversation, and happy International Women's Day.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Happy International Women's Day.